The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
All right, and tonight we are speaking with Micah Hanks once again. How you doing, Micah?
I think it's my first time on the show, so it's really great to be here with you.
Yeah, the first time this month.
Yes, indeed, my friend. How are you, buddy?
I'm fantastic. And you?
Oh, I'm doing good. You know, I mean, you and I always catch up a little bit before the show, and I always postulate that our pre-show banter could be an awesome show unto itself. You know, for those who would be willing to pay the amount in human organs, you know, that it would cost to be able to hear this clandestine banter that you and I share.
Well, it's where we share all the actual secrets of the universe that, you know, we're not allowed to talk about on the air.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know, those who are at the best and at the apex of what they do, they have to share their best secrets off the mic.
I mean, this whole UFO thing, we know what's going on, but we just, you know, if you tell people, there's nothing more to do after that.
Oh, yeah. Wait, hold on. Wait, we know what's going on?
Sure. That's what we were talking about before we. Oh, yeah, right. No.
Oh.
No.
That's what you were talking about with Randall Carlson.
Yeah. Yes. Wait, no. No one knows the secrets of the universe.
Well, if I hang around you long enough, maybe I'll learn them.
Although, honestly, if we did know the solution to all these mysteries, it would be a really boring place.
I kind of think it would. I mean, this is something that concerns me. Right off the bat, quick update. You know, I've been interested in, and we've talked about on the program in the past, the Brown Mountain Lights.
Yep.
1 week ago last night, I was down in the Linville Gorge observing illuminations at a distance. And, you know, I've actually acquired recently a new, very large Celestron telescope. It's a refractor, and so it's actually a telescope that, you know, a lot of astronomers, although it's really good for astronomy, backyard astronomy too. In fact, I think it's more than just a beginner telescope. The model that I'm using, being a refractor, a lot of astronomers would be like, oh yeah. But the thing is that I chose a refractor because these are also useful for viewing in daytime because they allow you to actually see your subject right side up rather than upside down. You don't get a reverse as a result of the actual construction of the reflection the mirrors compose on the interior of the telescope. So, you know, I chose a refractor that was a high-powered refractor, but still portable. And bottom line is I wanted something that would be useful both for my passion of backyard astronomy with a fairly serious bent, but also that would be useful for daytime observation or also just observation of things here on planet Earth rather than things that are emanating from 4.3 billion light years away or whatever. So, what I hope to be able to do is to better study the Brown Mountain Lights just as well. That's something I've been working on recently, and we've mentioned that again in the past on the program.
Have we actually talked about it?
I'm pretty sure that we've at least, you know, discussed it. I don't know that we've gotten really in depth about it, but
Want to briefly tell people what they are, like quickly, in case that we didn't? Because I'm not sure that we did. I know you've talked about it a lot on Grailian, but
sure. Well, I know that with regard to the Brown Mountain Lights, and also about your listenership, by the way. I mean, I've already told you this, but I was at the Fort Fest in Baltimore, Maryland last month, and literally within the first 10 minutes I was there, I walked in immediately following a presentation on Bigfoot given by David Politis, author of the Missing 411 books. I got to hang out with him just a little bit. I like David, great guy. I've emailed him, and I'm hoping to, you know, stay in touch with him about a few facets of his research that, he and I both are mutually interested in. Him, because the crux of his first book dealt with a particular case that involved the disappearance of a young boy, Dennis Martin, in the Great Smoky Mountains
right.
National Park. That's interesting to me because I live literally about an hour from there. And so he and I hope to exchange some notes. But I'll tell you this, an hour in the opposite direction is the Linville Gorge Wilderness, and that is the home of a phenomenon known as the Brown Mountain Lights. And so since I know that I run into your listeners all the time, for those who are new listeners of the program who may not have ever heard about this, it's essentially a what is referred to as a ghost-like phenomenon that occurs around the vicinity of Brown Mountain and the Black Mountain Range, just outside, and sometimes the phenomenon occurs within itself, the Linville Gorge Wilderness, which is between Linville Falls, Morganton, North Carolina, and also Boone, and a few other little localities up throughout the mountains. Beautiful, rugged, mysterious. And what is purported and what I've been the alleged witness to, and I say alleged because, you know, I'm pretty skeptical about the source of some of the illuminations that I've actually observed there. But what has been observed for almost a century, actually right at about a century, at Brown Mountain, and some claim earlier, but there's no verifiable data that supports this, but what has been seen in this region are strange illuminations that occur. And these illuminations sometimes appear to emanate from the horizon or from places in the valley. The really interesting ones lift into the air and travel through the air and sometimes take off like rockets. So I'm extremely interested in, you know, some of these kinds of reports of these lights, because if the Brown Mountain lights are indeed a valid phenomenon, they appear to be something that behaves a lot like ball lightning, but which manifest and which are of enough energetic potential that they maintain self-luminosity. They're self-contained, and they maintain this luminosity sometimes for several minutes, sometimes for even longer. I mean, there are reports of people seeing lights hovering in the sky above Brown Mountain that remain bright and obvious, and they'll move about, and they will remain for extremely long periods, in which case we have to question what is the source of the energy for these lights. So,
Well, before you get to that, they're very similar to the Marfa lights as well.
They are, yeah. The Marfa lights in Marfa, Texas. Hestalen, Norway is a similar locality for something like this. And also there are other places here in western North Carolina where I live where similar lights that hover around mountain peaks appear. As a matter of fact, Big Scaly Mountain up around Highlands, North Carolina, which is just next to the North Georgia border, that's another locality where there are purported earth lights that are seen. In fact, I imagine that there are probably a lot of them which aren't as popular in ghostly or Fortean lore as the Brown Mountain lights have become. In fact, Jerome Clark in his Unexplained, which was the title of his compendium that came out several years ago, it's gone through many different printings, and it's basically a collection of unexplained work on par with his UFO encyclopedia. Jerome Clark even included an entry on the Brown Mountain lights in his dictionary, or an encyclopedia rather, of the unexplained. So, you know, I think that the Brown Mountain lights are maybe one of the most famous of these earthlight phenomena, but they no doubt occur all over the place, Soraya. And, you know, I'm very blessed to live about an hour away both from where a lot of David Politis's work and interest is centered, which is, of course, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and the numerous disappearances that occur there, Bigfoot reports and things that have emanated from that region, folklore of all kinds of different other kinds of things that go on over there. And then in the opposite direction, then there are the Brown Mountain lights down the other side of the mountain. So it's a really, really anomalous region in which I inhabit here.
And what were you able to see with your telescope?
I have not taken my telescope to Brown Mountain yet. Okay. Now, yeah, the Sunday night that I was down there, I had placed an order. This telescope has recently arrived here at the bunker. And so I've been basically calibrating it, balancing it. You know, if you own a telescope, folks out at home who are astronomy enthusiasts know that, you know, proper maintenance of a telescope includes reducing stress on the actual mount. And so one thing that one has to do is they have to balance the telescope, and then you have to also learn, if you're not familiar with basically the polar regions of the sky, the way that you can literally find what is considered the, you know, depending on the hemisphere in which you are, the polar point in the sky. Typically, for instance, for someone where I exist in western North Carolina, I can find Polaris, and I can, within about a degree, find the north polar point, essentially, in the sky, which is the point representative of that which all stars will appear to circle around relative to the curvature or the spin of the Earth on a given night. Now, of course, that all changes depending on what time of the year, you know, what season you're looking at the sky, and frankly, what time of the evening just as well. But, you know, you can essentially learn to utilize your declination and different other attributes on your telescope to align with certain celestial objects that you can recognize. And so it helps, while you're going to be using a telescope to study the night sky, it helps to kind of have a familiarity with the night sky already. It helps to know some of the primary constellations, especially Ursa Minor, the Little Dipper, because, of course, Polaris is a part of that. You have to be able to associate these and identify them in the night sky so that you can properly align and attune your telescopes so that you can find other celestial objects. Now, again, with a refractor telescope, you can also observe, and the difference between a refractor from maybe a reflector or a Newtonian, of course, is the fact that this is going to be a telescope which is designed essentially with a long barrel that's going to allow you to see right side up, just as the eye would perceive, a distance away from where you're positioned, both on land as well as in the sky. And so for Brown Mountain research, and this is actually specifically what I had in mind when I bought the telescope, was setting up at a location like Wiseman's View. When these lights appear from time to time, whether they are airborne or whether they're on the adjacent ridges and they're unmoving, if they're remaining stationary, it would be interesting to be able to utilize a high-powered telescope to be able to observe these. But really, there's one thing I can think of, Soraya, that's better than observing from a distance through a telescope, and that is simply going to the location where the light appears to emanate from and literally be in close proximity to the light. And this is what is so mind-numbing to me about the reports of the science that that is allegedly being put behind the study of the Brown Mountain lights. And I actually have some friends in the scientific community who are doing this, so I don't in any way mean to demean their research. But the majority of people who study the Brown Mountain lights appear content to do so from a distance. You know, Darwin didn't sit in a boat and look through a telescope, at the shores of the Galapagos Islands and try and study the flora and the fauna. And he didn't devise his theories of evolution from a distance looking through an eyepiece. No, he went and he observed and he literally became a part of the environment and studied hands-on what was taking place in the localities where he began to formulate, of course, his evolutionary hypotheses. With the Brown Mountain lights, if there's indeed something of scientific merit to be studied, it's amazing to me that astronomers and physicists and, again, you know, researchers, trained geologists, people, you know, with the U.S. Geological Survey, like George Mansfield, who came down and studied in the 1920s, all of them utilize scientific implements to study the objects, but from a distance. And Mansfield in the 1920s was convinced that there was nothing more to the Brown Mountain lights than merely the oncoming headlights of trains at a great distance away. But keeping in mind, too, that in the 1920s there were fewer aircraft, you know, if any, in this region in the sky, Mansfield probably, and other researchers of his day, probably wouldn't have been looking to the skies for an explanation, and that we can't remove the number of reports that occur in the Lumbar Gorge that involve lights that are seen that are actually airborne. And although I've become much more skeptical of the number of reports that I hear in the Limville Gorge, I have a couple of friends, former scientists, actually engineers at Bell Laboratory, I should say more appropriately. Obviously very scientific, though, by virtue of their area of work. But Bill Fox and Bob Ashmore are their names, dear friends of mine. They were just in town this past week, and they were part of the reason I was down at Brown Mountain. And Fox and Ashmore have managed on numerous occasions to capture images of lights, some of them being airborne illuminations, which a geologist friend and I, after observing very carefully, plotting based on the date, the time, the position of the moon in the photographs relative to the object, and knowledge of the date during which this apparently anomalous object appears in the photographs, a light, we've been able to determine that it's not the moon, it's not a planet like Jupiter or Venus. In fact, it's no known star, and no star at that time of night or at that time of day or that time of year would be capable of producing enough visible light, even during a long exposure, to account for the object that appears in the photographs. The flight pattern does not appear to be consistent with an aircraft moving, although there is an aircraft just across I'd say more than across the ridgeline. I'd say that it's maybe a good 30 to 40 miles away, but there is an airport in the region. Occasionally, we observe aircraft leaving that airport, but again, the luminosity of the light in the photograph, which appears to be hovering over a locality called Table Rock as observed from Wiseman's View, appears to defy all easy explanation. And that doesn't mean, Soraya, that it couldn't be explained. But what it appears to be, based on what we know about celestial objects, the movement of objects through the sky, the position of the moon, and other factors contributing on this particular night, which occurred back in 2009, the same evening of the appearance of the supermoon, which peaked on a Tuesday evening. What we know is that we can't account with conventional sources of data what this object was. So it does appear to be an anomalous light hovering over the ridge. It's sad that, you know, my friends who are astronomers and other scientists, you know, can't seem to replicate this kind of information or seem to take enough interest in this kind of information to pursue it and try and obtain similar photographs, or more importantly, go to the top of a locality like Table Rock, which can, within about a 35-minute span, easily be reached, you know, the summit of the mountain. You can go up there, you can camp. There are plenty of camping spots. People do that all the time. So I'm amazed that with all the people who camp up there, no one seems to claim that they see these lights. No one's photographed these things, and no scientists have gone up there and tried to replicate the results of the photographs that Bill Fox and Bob Ashmore, my associates formerly of Bell Laboratories, have managed to garner. It's a fascinating case, but I don't think that enough real good science is being applied to trying to get to the heart of it.
We were talking about Andrew Collins before. Have you read his work on UFOs, like Light Quest or Alien Energy?
I have not.
Because Light Quest, one of the things he deals with is the possibility that UFOs are actually plasma intelligences.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because NASA scientific papers have, and I don't remember specifically in this case the author of the paper in question, but there was a paper that was issued. And NASA researchers had postulated the idea, the potential existence of plasma life forms in the vacuum of space. Now, I'll tell you a funny story, which I wouldn't normally tell on a program, but I think for whatever reason, I feel like I can get away with it on yours. I've got a good friend, and I can't name the astronaut. I do know his name, but I will respect this friend of mine and the email correspondences that I was made privy to, and I will not reveal the name of the associate or the astronaut, but I do know which astronaut specifically it was, and I've checked him out, and I know his I know his involvement with the space program over the last several decades. But this individual had contacted a friend of mine and had purchased an infrared telescope, and his interest in infrared had piqued interest in my friend who had been selling this on eBay. And he began to correspond with the gentleman, and this was how he learned about the NASA research papers that, again, in a speculative fashion, dealt with the idea of what some might call energizoa, or life that emerges from energetic forms, unlike life on Earth, but lifelike nonetheless, from the spontaneity of the vacuum of space itself. So it's kind of a roundabout interesting way. That doesn't necessarily add any more confirmation to the notion as espoused in such papers. I've read the actual paper in question, and I should try and find it so I could give you something more intelligent than just this kind of sporadic reference to it. But what's also interesting, by the way, is that, you know, when I talk about these kinds of things, I frequently engage colleagues of mine in the scientific community, me not being one. I am a journalist, and at most you might call a science writer, as well as an avid amateur scientist. I would consider myself, I don't have any kind of, you know, bachelor's degree, master's degree, or PhD or anything like that, you know. My training is minimal. I do have some college education, but I don't consider myself someone, you know, again, who has a systematic, well-trained, which includes lab time, well-trained scientist. You know, I'm an amateur in that sense. I am professionally a writer, but I'm also someone who I think is very well read in this subject, and so many of my colleagues in academia recognize that in me, and we share a lot of correspondence on some pretty some pretty heavy and thick subjects. But when I bring up things the likes of the idea of energetic life forms coming to exist in the vacuum of space, when I bring up things like, specialty journals of the science variety, like the late Charles Yost, again, former NASA engineer, who published a journal called Electric Spacecraft Journal, which had initially been instituted following his own personal sighting of what he called a UFO, a football-shaped glowing object that he saw over western North Carolina many, many moons ago, no pun intended. I bring this up to my astronomer friends, and they'll kind of poo-poo the idea of articles that would appear in this journal, and yet they have no idea that a journal under the title of Electric Spacecraft was actually published, and that the man who was the spearhead, you know, the gentleman who had been the spearhead behind it, had been a NASA engineer during the Apollo administration. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of data out there that in order to access, first of all, you have to be willing to look for it, and second of all, you also have to know where to look. And this is important because many people poo-poo the idea of certain anomalous phenomenon, whereas there have been scientific investigations of things that by all intents would be very anomalous if people were willing to take a look at the data, but oftentimes they don't know the data exists and they aren't interested in trying to find it.
True. And actually, this seems like a good lead-in to go into the article you had written. It was for the Grailian site, right?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the Google balloon article.
Yeah, and I found this to be really interesting and rather important, too, when dealing with the UFO phenomena.
Well, I think so, too. And I ask you this, actually, because I run my mouth plenty as it is. Soraya, what's interesting about this case, which I'm just providing commentary about, but what caught your attention about this case?
Well, you have shown from... why don't you go over what happened a little first?
Okay, sure.
And then I'll explain, you know, why I found it so interesting.
Sure. And for the listener at home, I already have a little foreknowledge, so I'm not putting your trusty neighborhood Soraya on the spot here. And I know we're very much on the same page, but for the benefit of the listener, I will identify kind of what happened here. Several witnesses back in autumn, I think it was around October, the middle of October in 2012, they had described seeing a long cylindrical, maybe illuminated object. And it appeared to be either hovering or maybe ascending already at a high altitude, but ascending into the sky over Pike County, Kentucky. And it was reported by a number of news sources, I think the Huffington Post and a few others, earlier this month. I think it was late in May where this was first being proposed, but news sources were jumping all over this and saying, yep, here we are, another UFO explained. And they were right. But what was happening was that it was revealed later that what the object was, this cylindrical object, had been was actually a known quantity in the very most sincere sense. As a matter of fact, quoting, what's his name? Let's see here. Rich DeVall, I believe. He's actually a Google X team leader with their rapid evaluation department. And he was speaking at a Smithsonian Magazine's The Future is Here festival in Washington, D.C. In about the middle of May of last year. But here's what he said. He says, this is a balloon that went rogue. No one outside Google X knows this, at least until he publicly stated so on May 17th at the Smithsonian Magazine event. So the news sources heard this statement. They were like, wow, oh man, that's cool. And sure enough, there had been a number of UFO reports over Kentucky around that time. Now, looking at Pike County on a map, I was interested in seeing if there were other areas within maybe, you know, 100, 200 miles who would have seen this object just as well. And so the first place that I decided, Soraya, to go and look for similar data, because I couldn't find any directly relating to Pike County, Kentucky. But I did go to the National UFO Reporting Center, moderated by Peter Davenport, and I managed to find not just one or two, but four reports from Johnson City, Tennessee, the same day, and within all about 2 hours of one another. And they all described an object that was seen. And as a matter of fact, I'll give you a quick breakdown here of what's going on. So it was October 16th, 2012, at 10 o'clock in the morning, local time. The first witness who reported seeing something described a rotating cylinder climbing vertically in the sky. They observed this for more than 1 hour over the Piney Flats area. An hour and a half later, a report was received by the National UFO Reporting Center. They, quote, observed a tube extended from a cylinder-shaped object on a clear day approximately for 1 hour. Now, both of these two reports within 2 hours of one another describe a cylinder. The next, at 11:45 a.m., described a silver, slow-rotating, pole-shaped object seen in broad daylight. This observation lasted for 7 minutes, and I lied because earlier I said it was all within 2 hours, when in truth actually 10 minutes beyond the jurisdiction of the two-hour mark. At 10 after noon, another report that was received by the National UFO Reporting Center described a metallic, cylindrical object seen hovering over Johnson City, Tennessee. This observer watched this object for 20 minutes. Now, it's pretty clear to me we know now, and if you look at photographs of the Google balloon, it's unmistakable. We know what this object was. This was actually a prototype, a test for the Google Wi-Fi project, where they hope to be able to mount large balloons high in the atmosphere, which deliver Wi-Fi internet to remote areas. This was a test. The balloon got away. The thing was seen all over the place. Reports from Pike County, Kentucky, although referenced by the media, I didn't find any on the UFO websites, but again, the National UFO Reporting Center had very clear data, which seemed to pertain, as I'm drawing the illusion here, which clearly seemed to pertain to what was seen over Johnson City on October 16th.
And what makes it so important is the fact that these descriptions were all pretty accurate to what people were actually seeing. And one of the arguments against UFO sightings is that people embellish, or they're not reporting exactly, you know, they saw the planet Venus and they just thought it was a pile of spinning lights or something to that effect. This shows that now that we know what it was and we can all take a look at it, that the descriptions were pretty dead on for what people were actually seeing.
They certainly were. They certainly were. And that's what I was getting at when I asked you what was significant about this, because that hits the nail on the head. That's the whole crux of the issue to me, is not the fact that, oh, well, you know what? Whatever people saw over Kentucky, guess what? They saw it over Tennessee, too. It's aliens. No. We know what this object was, but what's important is the fact that at the time that the witnesses who reported it to the National UFO Reporting Center, and you got to take into consideration, how many people do you think, as you're walking down the street every day, that you could walk up to, how many folks do you think you'd walk up to and say, tell me this, old bean, have you visited the website of the National UFO Reporting Center recently? How many of them would even know what the hell that is?
True.
The fact that there were four reports that were logged by the National UFO Reporting Center tells me that in likelihood, this was the minority of people in that locality, Johnson City, on the date of October 16th, 2012, who had any knowledge of the website and made the report, or who had seen something and who were interested enough that they would go online and they would try and find a locality or an institution or organization where they could make a report to, because they were convinced that something they'd seen was out of the ordinary. Now, that said, I suspect many more people than were reported, okay, by or through the National UFO Reporting Center on that date in that locality. I'm convinced that there were probably many more people who saw these objects.
Sure.
And furthermore, if the four cases that the NUFORC report are of any merit, yeah, what they indicate is that the four reports are remarkably similar in description. Three of them specifically state cylinder. And so, again, looking at the Google balloon, I mean, it's a very long tubular-shaped balloon. These people gave a very clear and accurate description of what they saw. Some described it as metallic or glowing, but again, this was kind of like it was kind of like a see-through kind of a plastic, so reflecting sunlight, it certainly could have given a metallic kind of a sheen or might have had a kind of a luminous appearance. And so, again, based on the altitude and the simple fact that most of these people who were reporting what they were observing had no real idea what they were looking at. Yeah, these research, or rather these descriptions are actually very good, and they do show that, in this instance, people weren't the notoriously unreliable witnesses that many UFO skeptics make UFO witnesses out to be. They were quite on par in terms of what they were observing.
Yeah, and that's something that That one incident is something that just, to me, is very important, because it does show that. And I don't think there's another incident like that where we can point to and have this list of reports that are all accurate and describe what was really there, that was an unknown, that was then identified, that we can then look at and say, yes, that is what they described.
We don't see a lot of them. That's for damn sure. We don't see a lot of them. And, you know, I think that that's something that we need to take into consideration because, you know, as UFO researchers, you know, I'm a big fan of the nuts and bolts thing. I've kind of wafted back and forth on that point over the years and you know, gravitated more towards this or that. And from time to time, I've gravitated away from nuts and bolts and more toward a, you know, an esoteric interpretation of UFOs. My mind likes to wander, but I recognize that if we hope to be taken seriously in a scientific sense, we've got to be very careful about the way that we approach UFO phenomena. And it helps to be able to understand the way that humans perceive that phenomenon just as well as it helps to be able to make nuts and bolts scientific determinations about what the phenomenon may be. So yes, this case, if it's important for any reason, it is important solely because it helps us show that people are not always terrible witnesses like the UFO skeptics say. And if you don't mind, I'd like to make one more point here with UFO skeptics. I say this often, and I'd like to say it again because, again, you know, with the growing listenership of your program, there are people who will stumble across this interview, and if they take nothing away from this, other than what I'm about to say, I'd like to make it known that I consider myself primarily skeptical. I am not a debunker. I'm not a disbeliever. I'm a person who tries to withhold judgment in the absence of facts.
And I'm pretty much the exact same way. And I don't really set on any one idea because my view of things will constantly change when new data comes along. I'm not dogmatic about anything.
That's right. Yeah, you and I, we have that in common. And you know, Soraya, bearing that in mind, I've probably said this before to you, but I'll say it again here. In my skepticism, I immediately become skeptical of any skeptic who claims that 100% of the time they can offer a mundane explanation for seemingly exotic phenomenon, such as what is often recounted in the better of the UFO reports that we have amassed over the last half century or so. Some of which include those which were categorized and classified and studied by the Project Blue Book investigators under the U.S. Air Force. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, of course, who had been a former advisor to Blue Book, initially a hardened skeptic who kind of, you know, released his skeptical viewpoints and became more open-minded and actually convinced of some sort of a phenomenon. Jacques Vallée, also a very skeptical researcher who has offered extremely esoteric interpretations of the UFO phenomenon, approaching it from a computer science and astrophysics perspective.
And he's also changed his view of it many times over his career.
Yeah, he certainly has, and you're absolutely right in pointing that out. Yeah, Jacques Vallée does what I think any good scientist would or should do. He doesn't become beholden to a theory because he realizes that theories change based on the influx of data that we attain.
Yeah. And and the thing is, the people who call themselves skeptics are not generally often skeptics. They are just debunkers. They have a set agenda. They have a set viewpoint. And they are claiming to be skeptics, but they're misusing the term. The term has been hijacked and taken away to mean that, well, you know, any of this crazy stuff isn't real, and here's why, because I'm a skeptic. As opposed to the true meaning of skeptic, which is you question everything.
Absolutely. And that's one reason, honestly, that, you know, prior to the broadcast here, we mentioned very briefly Joe Rogan. Yeah. I have to say, I've got a lot of respect for Joe Rogan. I didn't always, and the reason why was solely because I never really listened to what he had to say. I just always assumed, okay, this is how Joe Rogan is. You know, he doesn't seem like he's really a super intellectual kind of guy. I am comfortable and happy saying I was wrong, and what changed my mind about him was, again, what I observed during a episode of his podcast where he interviewed Brian Dunning. You know, someone like Joe Rogan can talk with someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson, again, you know, an astrophysicist and a guy who I have a lot of respect for. I don't necessarily disagree with him on his views on UFOs, although I do find that Neil deGrasse Tyson, depending on the audience, can tend to ham it up a good bit. But then again, I guess we all do. And I've seen him, you know, for instance, during the Amazing Conversations, I think is what it's called, He gave a presentation where amazing being a reference to the amazing Randy. This is in conjunction with the Randy Education Foundation. Neil deGrasse Tyson obviously hams it up and acts like UFOs are absolute absurdity. But I suspect that his real feelings are, well, sure, a person may see some sort of an unidentified flying object, but that doesn't mean it's alien. Well, but hey, Neil, do you think that that means that it could be something anomalous? Well, maybe, sure, it could be. But I think that really when we look at space and we look at the number of phenomena that exist out there, we're wasting our time trying to study something so limited and peripheral and fleeting as a UFO when we could try and study black holes or dark. You know, it's a typical kind of a scientific argument, and sure, that's fine. I understand why he would give that, and I see the merit to that. But I also think that in truth, if you were presented with good evidence for UFO reports, and there is some out there, it's a minority, but there is some good, you know, evidence, I think he might look at it and go, okay, maybe there is something more to this. Sure, we can't say it's aliens. Sure, we can't say it's anything, but it appears to be something more than just delusion.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely a phenomena. What the phenomena is still very open to interpretation and evidence. I do think, personally, that it has something to do with consciousness. I don't think it is a completely exterior to us phenomena. I think it interacts with us in a way we don't understand.
Well, you know, I don't know that you're all that far off base, you know, for those who would, again, prescribe to a much more nuts and bolts angle on this. I don't know that that's really something that we can say is all that far off base. I mean, you know, again, in trying to, in struggling to understand this phenomenon over the years, Jacques Vallée has often, you know, asserted that, again, he appears to think that there is something non-human in relation to the intelligence behind UFOs, and he furthermore seems to think that there is a control system, for lack of a better term, some sort of a control system underlying this, and not that he means to assert that this is, again, a phenomenon that is just trying to control people, you know, and that where are the, you know, the underlings to these extraterrestrial or interdimensional overlords or whatever it is. Quite the opposite, it seems that this phenomenon is capable of interacting with us, and maybe in a way that is difficult to put a finger on in the conventional modern sense. And so the control factor, he feels, is indicative of maybe some learning process that we're undergoing. I think that might be a fair way of trying to state it.
Yeah.
But while it is controlling in the sense that it is perhaps to an extent shaping human evolution, he doesn't think that there's an overt, you know, kind of an evil enslavement kind of a control going on. And nonetheless, he also thinks that it may transcend physicality as we know it, which brings us back to the idea of conscious related phenomenon that you mentioned. Vallée seems to prescribe to the idea that indeed if there is a phenomenon, how it controls or communicates or works with us in the parameters of a so-called control system has something to do with human consciousness, perception, understanding, determinations, and observations of physical reality, recognition of symbols and symbolic interactions and things like this, which is a very deep subject we could have or we could discuss separately at some time. But the psychology underlying UFOs doesn't necessarily have to mean, oh, people imagine what they see. And I've said that, I think that, you know, in many instances I've said I think that there's a psychological component, and people have gotten angry with me because they think that I'm asserting that people are imagining or, you know, producing the experience of thinking that they have seen a UFO. I don't assert that in the least. I just think that the levels of perception and sensory awareness that humans waft between from time to time in relation to the way that we perceive our environment, you take that into consideration alongside the high strangeness reports of UFOs, and you cannot deny the fact that there's probably some conscious relation, some sort of an element, you know, that is related to consciousness, I should say, that is part and parcel to this phenomenon. And I think that that's what Vallée has determined, and I think that even, you know, some of the more recent commentators on this phenomenon have hinted at. As a matter of fact, there's this fabulous new book that's come out called Science Skeptics and UFOs, A Reluctant Scientist Explores the World of UFOs. It's written by B. Timothy Pennington, Ph.D. He is a chemist by trade and a member of the American Chemical Society. And in this book, toward the end, he kind of goes through his, delineation of, well, here are the more likely elements, and here's the most likely this or that and everything. What is UFO phenomenon most likely to be? And he never resolves and says, based on what I've observed, this is what I think UFOs are, but he gives a listing of different elements and then kind of notes the probability of each. And in this listing, the only one that seems to really hold water is the idea of there being some sort of an interdimensional phenomenon. And interdimensional, I think, could be composed of several things. One, it could be some sort of a phenomenon that exists right here in our physical space-time that warps space and time in a dimensional sense or in terms of dimensionality so that it can interact with us here in our space-time environment. Two, a dimensional phenomenon could also be a non-temporal phenomenon, which is something that might emanate from our future or past, which again warps dimensional space to interact with us in what we perceive as our present. And then three, there's the possibility of a parallel dimension or a dimensional reality beyond what we recognize as our known universe, which utilizes some sort of advanced physics to literally traverse the boundaries between dimensions and interact within our own. So he never states it in that kind of wording, but he hints at that. And those are my own three delineations within the idea of there being some sort of a dimensional phenomenon. More and more people are kind of gravitating toward that. And I take very seriously the possibility that indeed in some capacity there is a dimensional phenomenon that is perhaps underlying the more high strangeness and complex UFO cases.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Micah Hanks.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, so let me present you with this. The problem with the UFO phenomenon is often that the best ideas always have holes in them. Like you think, oh, this fits perfectly, except for that piece. And no matter which way you look at it, there's always a piece that doesn't fit, so, which is one of the reasons there's no solid explanations for UFOs. So what if the lights are not directly related to, say, encounters with these things? What if the lights are a side effect of something like a plasma ejection from the Earth or these earthquake lights and things like that? It's a natural phenomena that occurs under certain circumstances. And under those same circumstances, they affect our consciousness. The lights have nothing to do with it. The lights are just another affect of whatever that is that's emanating and creating the lights. And we're actually interacting with, or not so much interacting with, but it's putting us in an altered state of consciousness where we can interact the same way we would on ayahuasca or something like that with these entities and with these beings. And we just associate the light with it because we saw a light. And maybe the light even morphs into some of the hallucination or the altered state because we're in that zone. Now, the problem is there's physical evidence, and that's what throws it off.
Oh, that's a very interesting idea. I want to come back to the idea that the lights, and if I am interpreting what you're describing here correctly, the idea is that the lights are the after effect of some sort of a...
Like an energy zone or something.
Sure, you know, or as I would like to consider it, you know, maybe, you know, if you have a chemical reaction occurring, sometimes you'll see... you know, a mist or something rising off of what is obviously a solution, you know, some sort of a chemical solution, you know, that's a liquid. And the effect of the reaction might be that, you know, you know, a certain gaseous vapor will rise off of it, and you'll observe that. But, you know, the heart of the reaction is what's going on in the liquid sense. If a UFO represents a reaction in our space-time, the light could be representative of the vapor rising off of the surface of the beaker in the example that I outline here. So, you know, I'm reminded of the Mr. X case. Soraya, do you remember that one?
Probably, but remind me.
Sure, yeah, it was a case. As a matter of fact, I think one of the best documentation and analyses of that case was afforded us by Dr. Jacques Vallée in his book, Confrontations, A Scientist's Search for Alien Life. And in that book, the Mr. X case was discussed, in which an Italian man had essentially injured his leg in a wood cutting accident. He steps outside onto a balcony one evening after waking up and hearing his infant child crying, and he goes and calms the little baby and sees a light outside, and he steps out onto his balcony and he observes what appears to be a large, well, if I remember correctly, it wasn't one saucer, it was actually a pair of saucer-shaped craft that had some sort of antenna protruding from them. And this object appeared to be communicating with the counterpart. This antenna seemed to be communicating some sort of a something between the two craft. And as Mr. X observed the two craft, he says, they began to move toward one another. And before long, he said that they merged together into one object and then kind of shifted forward, beamed a light toward him, and then took off. The injury that he had sustained from the wood cutting had healed miraculously within a few days, but for months after the fact, he had described having these strange rashes that appeared on his chest, and there were photographs that actually documented this, which Vallée includes in the images in his book. But there was this other aspect to this that was really bizarre too, where people had apparently come to this Mr. X, and obviously he valued his privacy, and so he didn't, you know, he wasn't very forthcoming with his identity and who he was, and, you know, obviously who his family was and where they lived. But he had claimed to have these MIB kind of encounters with people also, you know, strange things, missing time even, you know. So there were a lot of weird aspects to this case, but the fundamental element to the case involved this sighting of this object. And so what was always interesting to me about it was seeing these two saucers merge together as one. And I remembered, in fact, actually on his program, Cosmos, the original Cosmos, not Neil deGrasse Tyson's recent revamp, but Carl Sagan's original Cosmos, he talked about the flatland analogy. And the idea that, for instance, to a, you know, and this is pretty difficult to wrap one's head around, but for instance, a two-dimensional being is going to, for instance, if a three-dimensional object intersects its reality, it's going to perceive a cross-section of a three-dimensional object.
John Keel mentions this, too.
Yeah, John did mention this.
As if someone puts their finger down onto a piece of paper, that two-dimensional surface doesn't see the finger coming down.
Yeah.
It just sees it suddenly appear, and then as the finger's lift up, it just disappears into thin air, and there's no way to see the full form of what just appeared.
More interesting, even, is if we back it from the two-dimensional perspective to the one-dimensional perspective. You know, imagine a linear plane where a one-dimensional being, just his whole life is really boring. He just goes back and forth. And, you know, physics students, you know, are going to be really bored with this because you've probably heard this, but bear with us. The one-dimensional little being, a little yellow fuzzy critter, goes back and forth along this dimensional plane. And let's say that a two-dimensional object, maybe resembling a horseshoe shape, begins to pass along and it intersects this one-dimensional plane. So what happens? A horseshoe, and think about it, if you took a U shape, like the letter U, and you drew a line directly through it, your line is going to intersect with the U on two points, okay, through the two stems of the U. to the one-dimensional creature, if this U-shaped two-dimensional object intersects its one-dimensional plane as it's passing along, it is going to perceive an object that appears, and this is, as you and I know, being able to observe it not just two-dimensionally but three-dimensionally, we know that there is an object, a single object, that bisects a one-dimensional plane in two locations. The one-dimensional being, as it passes the two points where the two-dimensional object bisects its reality, it will perceive maybe that there are two objects rather than a single, and it is perceiving two parts of a whole. Now, return again to the analogy of Mr. X, and he sees what appear to be two objects, two UFO-type saucer craft that are hovering. There's antennae on them, and they are beaming little electrical charges back and forth as they come closer and closer, and then they merge together as one. And I wonder sometimes if there is not a component of the UFO phenomenon which may be representative of a fourth dimensional reality, or at very least an extra dimensional reality, which perceived by us in our three dimensional waking space sometimes appears to defy the laws of our known physics or extend beyond what is easily accepted in our reality. What if the evidence of a fourth dimensional UFO are the kinds of things like what Mr. X reported seeing, or a UFO that is capable of apparently passing through space at incredible speed and then just vanishing into thin air and then an hour later reappearing and then taking off again at incredible speed? These kinds of things are all reported in UFO literature, and yet we have no way of really coming to terms with what exactly they are supposed to convey or what exactly they actually mean.
Well, you also got to consider how many UFOs we've now picked up in infrared that don't show up in our vision, that are outside the realm of what we can perceive, that don't necessarily have to be extra dimensional to do that.
They wouldn't. They certainly wouldn't. They would just have to extend beyond the senses, which again, you know, this points out the limitations of the human senses. You know, I had the benefit of interviewing a gentleman recently by the name of Neil Harbison. Are you familiar with who Neil Harbison is?
No.
Neil Harbison is a cyborg activist. He's an Englishman, although I think his heritage is actually in other parts of Europe. Neil lives, I think, part of the year in New York. But he has an actual antenna attached to the back of his skull, and it's permanently attached there. And this thing comes up over the front of his face and everything, and there's this little probe that kind of hovers in front of his forehead. And Neil's essential affliction was that he was born colorblind and he wanted to be able to perceive colors. And so he has this antenna that allows him to perceive things about the color of an environment. And this is how he overcomes the disability of colorblindness as a visual artist. It's really fascinating. But now here's what's really even more interesting. Neil's antenna allows him to perceive infrared and ultraviolet as well, and how it is communicated to him is either through tones that the device produces or through direct resonance with his actual, in other words, vibration through the appendage itself connected directly with his bone, the bone of his skull. So, interestingly, he says, if I enter a room where there are infrared objects, for instance, if there's a camera hidden or someone points some sort of an infrared light at me, I can detect that. I'm aware of it. Whereas that falls outside the normal reaches of the human senses.
Sure.
So again, you know, this is something that I tried to drive home in the UFO singularity. Eventually, our technology will probably allow us to perceive things about the environment that right now escape us, but which one day may become commonplace once we reach a level of technological proficiency at perceiving whatever that may be. And I think that certain UFO phenomenon could easily extend beyond the reach of the senses in a very similar way. And maybe people like Mr. Harbison are the first of the eventual, again, it's a hot subject and a bit of a sore one too, but the eventual superhuman variety of people who embrace transhumanism and technology in such a way that will improve upon their natural biological ability to perceive in a sensory way things going on in their environment. It could be that the UFO phenomenon is as real as night and day, as real as the blades of grass that we walk across on our way to the mailbox every afternoon, but that it just extends at times into a portion of the sensory range which is beyond that of the human biology.
Sure. And John Keel back in the Eighth Tower talked about how UFOs would fade out into the ultraviolet or come from the ultraviolet when people saw colors, which, again, suggests that these things could exist just beyond our ability to see them. And we have videos of UFOs. There's a great video that I always reference. It was actually on UFO Hunters, of a police helicopter in Florida with a UFO following them that they couldn't see with their naked eye, but the night vision camera was picking it up.
Isn't that interesting?
But then, if you look at ghost hunters, aren't they sort of doing the same thing at times, where they have these instruments to detect, you know, electromagnetic fields and ultraviolet, and they think, well, you know, the ghosts are coming in from this field, but maybe they're all the same thing.
Well, you know, and I don't mean to be dismissive by any means of the ghost hunters, but I do feel at times that the ghost hunters are, you know. I am a bit skeptical of the amount of phenomena that ghost hunters claim to be able to capture.
Agreed.
You know, I mean, I hope that doesn't sound like I'm, you know, because again, I really think that ghostly phenomenon probably represents a real phenomenon. But I also feel that whatever that phenomenon is it is far more transitory based on my own experiences. You know, I mean, I know how it is to try and go into a purported haunted environment. You don't have weird stuff happen every time and everywhere you go. If there's real science to be applied to the subject, you know, whatever these television programs manage to be cooking up with incredible consistency is probably not it.
Yeah, well, that's it. And they're television programs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they have to come up with something. If most of their show is them not finding anything, they're going to lose their audience pretty quickly.
Not finding Bigfoot.
Yes, and I think that's also why a lot of the UFO shows have failed, because you can't just go out and videotape a UFO.
But a lot of people try to.
Well, sure, but you're not going to be able to get it to perform on camera.
I think it's going to become more and more difficult to quantify the UFO phenomenon, though, because, I mean, for instance, here, this report literally appeared online today. The CBS affiliate in Seattle had reported this, that police are now investigating a report of a drone, which a woman claimed was hovering outside of her window. Apparently, and again, you can kind of expect that this kind of thing is probably going to happen more and more, but police were called to basically investigate what the woman claimed was a drone spying on her. Huh. As it hovered outside of her apartment building, looking literally inside the window. Now, apparently, an employee of the apartment where she actually resides went outside and said that immediately following the call to the police, she had seen two men who she believed were piloting the drone, and that when they realized that they were being observed, they packed up their gear, and they had a video camera with them, too, and that they drove off before the police arrived. The police are trying to find the guys who were piloting the drone, but the point is that, you know, again, we've got drones all over the place. In my book, The Ghost Rockets, you know, I'll just tell you right now, I think pretty strongly that, especially later in the book when we talk about the modern cases of these things showing up, there's some kind of drone technology that's being utilized that, you know, you or I and maybe some of our military organizations, and certainly not the FAA, you know, we're pretty much in the dark on this sort of thing. But civilian drones are being piloted and used with growing frequency, and it's getting to a point where there are all kinds of things buzzing around in the sky, and it may become more and more difficult with time for us to look at these things and go, ah, you know, look, UFO, here's the smoking gun. If we don't know exactly what all is in the sky and we see something that we can't easily identify, I mean, again, by definition, it's a UFO, but the known technologies available to us may muddy that water, and it may become more and more difficult to really point out something that's truly anomalous.
And the problem with any modern UFO anything, I mean, A, there's that. There's so much stuff buzzing around. B, who knows how far ahead the military is than they let us know about. And C, it is so easy to fake stuff on video and photographs nowadays.
It is. It certainly is. Yeah, computer technology has really improved and made things, again, Very difficult. It's allowed a new level of difficulty.
And, I mean, the military could have stuff that is beyond stuff we could even imagine, and they don't have to tell us.
No, they don't. You know, which, again, makes it difficult for us because, you know, civilian researchers, arguably, there is a majority of this phenomenon that we are seeking, which probably there is an explanation for, but which we simply don't have access to data on. And, you know, I hear different people come, you know, around every, you know, few years, and they'll point out, John Alexander being one of them, I think, that they point out that, you know, there's too much of this for government to successfully have managed to maintain and keep hidden. And if you really think that there's a phenomenon here, you can't presume that a government agency would do such a good job at keeping it hidden. But the thing is that I don't think we can maybe look to just one government agency. I think that this is something that runs the gamut and is far more broad than, again, people are willing to be made aware of. And really, education shows with time that there's probably a lot more going on behind the scenes than we realize. Some of that would have to account for what we're dealing with. But again, I think it's, you know, to try and say that, well, Congress knows about what the UFO phenomenon is and they're keeping that information from us. Yeah, sure, they wouldn't do a good job keeping secrets, but there'd be organizations, entities, you know, agencies that would.
Black projects.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, there's the whole thing with the government hiding anything, like the main portion of the government. That's exactly the problem. They wouldn't be able to hide it. Someone would let it out. They would slip up. But even the military, it seems like they don't generally... you know, we find out about these things when they want us to find out about these things. You know, we didn't find out about the stealth bomber because someone leaked it or there was, you know, they couldn't keep a secret. They pretty much released the information.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And often that release of information occurs in conjunction with a release of information pertaining to something else that just so happens to have information about something that somebody, you know, in a totally different area may find interesting. You know, for instance, you know, information about U-2 spy planes and things like that being released may lead to data about Area 51, which I think we really essentially had happen earlier this year.
Right.
Depending on what the circumstances are, there are any number of reasons why certain data may end up being released and people may stumble upon it. It may not have to do with the kinds of things that people who end up finding it were looking for to begin with. It's a pretty nebulous statement, but really, again, I think that we have to take into consideration, especially in this field of research, the likelihood of accidental inquiry and the accidental discovery, more importantly, of various, you know, perceived anomalies. I think that, you know, things that we stumble upon in the most literal sense often yield some of the most fascinating discoveries.
And the other thing is, people will jump to, well, we couldn't have invented that ourselves. We must have alien technology. And I don't think that, I think that really insults the integrity and the intelligence that some people do have, and the originality of different ideas. We see people that are so far ahead of their time. If they lived a few decades or a few centuries later, they would have reinvented everything for us. So to say that this stuff couldn't have been invented without alien technology is kind of ridiculous. There are some brilliant people out there, and who knows what they're working on or how they're thinking about it. And I think the same thing tends to apply to the whole ancient alien idea. They see these huge monuments. Well, we couldn't have done that, or, you know, humans couldn't have done that. It must have been aliens. And whether or not they're ancient aliens, I don't think that argument holds any water.
Huh. Yeah, and I'm trying to remember the argument that was brought forth either by Tyler or myself, Tyler being one of the co-hosts of the Gray Alien Report podcast that I do. But I'm trying to recall the statement. We were saying that, you know, basically people initially didn't believe that humans were capable of this, the pyramids or other ancient monuments, and so we assert aliens, and now we do the same thing with something else. I'm really drawing a blank trying to remember. It's probably just because I'm tired and old. You know, a lot older than I look, by the way, but but if it comes back to my mind, I'll bring it to mind. But either way, the point is that you know, when we try and assert, I think, that there's no plausible explanation for any kind of a phenomenon based on the fact that we presume that humans never could have innovated it itself. You know, whether you apply it to the pyramids and to ancient technologies or to certain phenomena, and again, I don't know that I can say that with certainty, and I certainly can't with certainty, Soraya, say that, that all UFO phenomenon today is representative of something that is Earth-based. I can't prove that. I couldn't tell you that in confidence that I think that that's what's going on either. But I can certainly say that we can look at ancient mysteries and we can say humans couldn't possibly do that. Maybe we, after a fashion, do the same thing with modern mysteries. And we always undermine human potential when, in fact, it could be that UFOs, just as much as the pyramids and just as much as any number of different ancient mysteries, do have their basis in humanity and the innovations, surprising as they may be, that humans have come upon or, as I mentioned earlier, stumbled upon for various reasons.
And I'm not saying that there's not a genuine mystery. I truly believe there's a genuine UFO mystery. It's just that, you know, we see something in the sky that behaves in a way that we say, well, we don't have anything that could do that. Really? How do we know what we have? They don't tell us what we have. And, you know, it could, and for that matter, I mean, when we see these things moving and people will say, well, someone couldn't survive that turn, they could have been unmanned drones back then. I mean, even in the 80s, who knows how long they've had working functional drones that could do some really impressive stuff that they just never told us about.
Oh, yeah. And I wonder about that, honestly. You know, and I mentioned to you James Carrion, you know, the former international director of MUFON, who's written this book, The Rosetta Deception, which, you know, kind of looks at the idea of intelligence operations aimed at basically skewing information and, of course, you know, feeding false information to world powers, namely Russia, following the Second World War. And he kind of ties this all in with the ghost rockets thing, which I've written about. And I find that fascinating because it shows that there's this level of reality to this phenomenon that is not the reality that we think that it is, i.e., what we're dealing with is, if anything, the presumed or the creation of a presumed phenomenon that is something that people utilize for purposes of gain, whether it be espionage or, you know, this or that. And it brings to mind this idea for me that with or without proof of a UFO phenomenon, a UFO doesn't have to exist for the cultural influence that it's had to exist. For, and interestingly, you know, the national security interest. I mean, you know, government agents may not, as we reportedly know today, take UFOs all that seriously. Maybe at one time they did, but, you know, again, today, if we believe conventional wisdom, they don't seem to take UFOs very seriously. But I think that what we see is the possibility that even from a national security standpoint, UFOs also have had a profound influence on just not just the United States government, but I mean world governments all around. I remember a few years ago I put together a kind of a collection of articles, links to articles that detail different UFO investigational groups, some of them government and some of them civilian around the world. Many of them directly related to disclosure of UFO documents from Air Force organizations and things like that in different countries around the world. And so the case I'd try to make was that essentially, although it may be a slow process and a continuing process, disclosure is kind of happening all around the world. And, you know, I guess after a fashion, you could kind of say that, you know, that with or without the existence of a UFO, their widespread use in culture and their widespread influence has been both culturally and also in government agencies and also with regard to national security and all different levels of you know, our culture and society, from country to country, you know, culture to culture. It's a fascinating thing. And the UFO is undeniably a part of all of that. with or without this physical component. I hope people kind of understand what I'm trying to say there, because, you know, I'm not trying to say that, well, UFOs may not exist. I'm just saying that they wouldn't have to exist to have had the impact on our culture that they have already inevitably had.
Well, they've also been used by the government to hide top secret projects or to sway interest away from things.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true also. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's pretty clear that during the 1940s, the late 1940s, UFO reports were probably fed to media agencies for purpose of, you know, again, espionage. I cite an instance, I think, that occurred in 1946 where the New York Times reported a UFO, a disc-shaped or, you know, hovering metallic disc or bell-shaped object hovering over the Thames River that appeared to have a, what was it? It was a, it wasn't actually the Nazi insignia. I think it was the Iron Cross.
Yeah.
Appeared on this object, and that it was hovering over the Thames River. No, it couldn't have been 1946. And I remember it was later because it was after the publication of media reports of flying saucers following Kenneth Arnold's sighting. And so the idea was that I wonder if intelligence agencies might have exploited that idea for purpose of trying to fool other world superpowers who they knew at the time were reading our newspapers and looking for stories just like that, which might have been evidence of who knows anything from, you know, rocket scientists, Nazi rocket scientists coming to work for the U.S. space program to who knows what else.
It's such a confusing mess, really, when you look at it, because there's so many different angles and things coming from so many different directions. I also wanted to clarify that when I say that, you know, I don't think that alien technology is necessary for the stuff that we had, I'm not saying that it's impossible that we have alien technology, just like I'm not going to say it's impossible that there were ancient aliens. I just think that there's a jump in logic there, and we don't give people enough credit, especially ancient people, enough credit to have come up with ways to do this themselves. I mean, who knows what kind of culture might have existed that we're not aware of ages ago?
Who knows?
And who knows what kind of geniuses these black projects may have working for them today?
It's difficult to say. Yeah, but I mean, again, you know, we can't necessarily undermine human ingenuity. They may really have a lot more going for them than we think.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up. You sound like you're actually fading a bit.
No, me never. No. Actually, I won't lie, but yeah, it's been a grueling period lately, which involves typically the following: very early mornings, very late evenings, the nights that I'm not doing my own shows, podcasts, radio, or whatever. You know, I'm you're traveling around and doing music and all this kind of stuff, and so yeah, it can be a little grueling. But you know, when you're devoted to this stuff, you have to kind of. You have to just kind of grin and bear it like the grinning man. So, grinning. Man.
Would you trade it for anything?
I wouldn't. You absolutely.
Okay.
No, I wouldn't. No, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. I wouldn't trade it for a grinning man. We'll have to talk about it, you know, on down the road. That's a whole different discussion into itself.
True. All right. Well, people can find you on the air when.
Well, I'm on the air on Monday nights on the KGRA Radio Network at 7 p.m. Tuesday nights, they can find me via GraylianReport.com at 8 p.m. East Coast time. We record the Graylian Report podcast at that time, but it broadcasts live. And people can tune in and listen. And all the information about me, gosh, all the stuff about everything that I do is available at MicahHanks.com and then GraylianReport.com as well.
And you also have the podcast with Jim Harold you're doing, right?
Well, that's a video cast, believe it or not. Yeah, we're doing this paranormal report. And, that's a cool project because Jim launched that years ago with Clayton Morris, who is now one of the hosts of Fox and Friends. And, you know, Clayton, of course, with his professional interests, it's very difficult for him to continue doing the Paranormal Report. And so Jim had long wanted to relaunch it. And so in this incarnation, I've got a very hard act to follow. A big fan of Clayton's here, and I think he's one of the funniest people, as well as a really intelligent and fun guy. Somebody who's, who follows everything and who's really interested in technology and has a genuine interest in the paranormal, too. But I'm having a lot of fun with Jim Harold, and we're really enjoying the program, this newly revamped version of the Paranormal Report, which goes live online every Friday evening. You can find that at Jim Harold's website, jimharold.com, as well as the aforementioned GraylianReport.com. I always have that linked up over there as well.
And you got daily news as well on the Grellian Report if people want to subscribe to it or check out your site.
I've got this weird thing that I'm doing too. In addition to the daily news, I don't know if a lot of people have seen this, but actually there is a farm, which we have started here in Western North Carolina, of midget giraffes that we are now promoting through GrellianReport.com. No, I'm totally messing with you, Spray.
That's a great idea, though. I think you should go for that.
I already think I might.
You need more to do. I mean, you're just... Yeah.
Well,
so, we're going to end... We're going to end...
You.
We're going to end with some music from you. What are we going to hear?
You're going to hear... This is something special. Since for the last couple of times, we've done this Never Without You. And I'll tell you this, by the way. I've been in touch with, recently, Frederick Valentich's the girl who had been his fiance at the time of his disappearance. I'm hoping to speak at length with her about the case I'll tell you this, is still involved in and interested in UFO reports, and so I'm hoping to remain in touch with her. But that said, since we've heard that song a couple of times already, I thought we'd take it back in the day to my long-haired days with my former rock group Black Hook. And I think what we're going to hear tonight is a song that is called Midnight Driver, which is it has nothing to do with anything we've been talking about, but I think a few of them might enjoy it, especially if you're a fan of the kind of music that this young gentleman, Soraya, presents on his other programs. He's quite the musicologist in his own right. So I submit for your approval, Black Hook performing Midnight Driver.
All right. Thanks, Micah.
My pleasure, brother.
Take a ride and I don't mean a maybe. Would you get mad if I told you was pretty? My car is clean, it's my mind that's dirty. Yeah. Well, I could take you home, you know I never really try to hurt you. I guess I need to have things right away. But driving all night long is all I got left to call. I'll keep it down as long as I get paid. So I'll be hitting the highway my way.
Pedal to the metal, just a gal in a town. Light me from the smokestack, oh, oh, my, my. Hope to God I see your face tonight. 100 fifths of whiskey and I'll be damn fine. Midnight driver, just a toe in the line. Come on, man, just cut another line.
See you shake it, honey. You know tomorrow you'll have all my money. I drove all day and I plan to stay all night. You look so good, baby, I can't promise I won't bite. Yeah. Well, I could take you home. You know I never really try to hurt you. Driving all night long is all I got left to call a virtue. I'll keep the job as long as I get paid. So I'll be hitting the highway my way.
Pedal to the metal, did you get out of town? I'm ripped from a slow tech, oh, oh, my, my. Hope to God I see your face tonight. 100 fifths of whiskey and I'll be damn fine. Midnight driver, just a toe in the line. Come on, man, just